Hello everyone, before I start, if you'll forgive me, I have a podcast recommendation for you all. It's called the British Food History Podcast. I recommend it to you on the rigorous selection process that I really like it, and maybe you will too. Also, it's a great and rich subject. Most of all, though, I really like the host, who is Dr. Neil Buttery, and he really knows what he's talking about. He's an author, a PhD in the subject, he's got a really good blog as well, actually. But the main thing is he's an absolute and total enthusiast, and that to me is the heart of independent podcasting. He's doing it because he loves his subject, primarily. He's a warm and lovely host, he has lots of really great guests. So Diane Purkis of The People's History of the Civil War fame, she was there for example. She's now done The People's History Approach to Food. There's one just out on medieval food and one I absolutely loved on school meals. How I laughed at that one and cried just a little bit at the memory of the tubes in school liver. So much yuck. Anyway, it's great. Give it a go on your normal podcatcher, the British Food History Podcast with Dr. Neil Buttery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello everyone and welcome to Anglo-Saxon England, Series 2, Land, Lordship and People, Episode 4, The Shire. In Land, Lordship and People, we are talking about the development of Anglo-Saxon society, how it arrived in the British landscape, how its economic and social relationships worked and developed, what made it distinctive, and how will it fundamentally change with the Norman Conquest. So far in our series, we have talked about the theories around the Adventus Saxonum, England's basic foundation story. In last week's episode about early settlers, we then talked about how that worked in our area of South Oxfordshire, how the process of settlement was affected by landscape and is still reflected in landscape. We talked a bit about the emergence of simple hierarchies, earlish and churlish, nobles and the armed free farmers known as churls. This time I'm going to talk about how those early groups of settlers, family and tribal groups and their lords began to organise into larger groups and political units as lords gradually accumulated relationships with dependent churl families through commendation. Through this process, nobles and lords, and increasingly kings, acquired groups of farms and farmers on large territories with multiple farms and estates. These territories we are going to call shires. We're going to talk about how lords manage these large areas and the concept of extensive lordship, which essentially means the opposite to intensive. So, the hand of the lord on the land and the people was relatively light in a period of widely dispersed settlement, a world with an emerging moral economy, accepted ways of doing things. The word for this unit of land, this political unit, the word shire, then, is an Old English word which is derived from the Germanic word for care, in the sense of something being in your care or charge. Therefore, something you needed to govern or administer or look after. It's a word that plays to the idea we talked about last time of the moral economy, a sharing of reciprocal rights and obligations between ruler and ruled, a relationship which puts the churl family in the care of the lord to whom they gave tribute. Shire is the same word as our modern shire, so in common with an author called Rosamund Faith, I am going to use shire to distinguish it from the later shire, which would be much larger units with more modern implications. Rosamund Faith, by the way, wrote a popular book called The English Peasantry and the Growth of Lordship, and it is a work of genius. Although when I say popular, by the way, I mean not that popular with the book by a public, since it's pretty hard to get. I think I saw it in an online second-hand bookshop, which shall remain nameless, at the cool £206. This is a shame, but I'm sure, or at least I hope, that your local library will get it for you. Anyway, where were we? Oh yes, shires. These early shires might be pretty large. They might be 100 square miles, for example. These are substantial areas. But of course, even 100 square miles is not the kind of area we associate these days with mighty and puissant kings and queens. But in the society of the time, when people moved around so much less, they were much more meaningful units of group identity, of the kind of scale that people could cope with. Powerful local identities like this survived much longer than you might think. So in the 17th century, people would refer to the community they identified with as their country. And when they said that, more often than not, they were referring to their county, not to a country like England. Even in late 19th century Oxfordshire, people still spoke of a place apparently called Banburyshire, Banbury being just one town within Oxfordshire. So, local loyalties. Over time, people and territory began to be associated with each other, become tribal areas and kingdoms. Again, there are reasons for that. One is around the identity of lordship. So, in the Deben Valley in Suffolk, this is the territory where all the households owed allegiance to Wafa, and they are Wafingers. So, go to your local shire, insert the name of their people as applicable, the Wafingers Shire. But also, these territories have their own characteristics which kind of defined the rules of societies in a way, their own internal logic driven by landscape. The physical characteristics of the Chiltern Hills, then, with its woodlands and pastures, that gave rise to the idea of the tribe of the Chilternsyten. But another even better example are the fenlands of East Anglia, complex wetland environments, where survival depended absolutely on sharing resources and common rights and working in the same way in a difficult landscape, to manage pasturage, haymaking, managing water supply, reed beds, and all that sort of thing. So that led to the development of customs and procedures about jointly managing those resources, balancing individual rights and entitlements with the needs of the wider community. So those become well-established customs and practices handed down from generation to generation. These reciprocal rights and obligations were then shared by the people in the shire, which became known as the land of those people, the land of the Spalda, for example, in the Fenlands. They are aware of their joint identity, and they are tenacious of their rights. So, when Croyland Abbey was established, they extended claims over the lands that had been granted to them, with which the locals did not completely agree, I think it's fair to say. So, 3,000 of them gathered outside the abbey to make clear their rights and defend them against the abbey's claims. While they're away protesting, incidentally, presumably bearing the Anglo-Saxon equivalent of banners and high-vis clothing, they organised some of their community to stay behind and manage all their lands on their behalf. So, very community-oriented. Over time, of course, the lord of a shire might find themselves gently persuaded to give their allegiance to a more powerful lord or king, or else. And so these shires, these old petty kingdoms, if you like, would become part of something much larger, part of a kingdom of, say, East Anglia or Northumbria, depending where they were. Some of these, then, are named in that surviving catalogue of kingdoms, the tribal hidage, which I mentioned last time. The Spalder are mentioned there, for example. The shears on which larger kingdoms or tribal groups are based often survive for a long time, large and small, in different forms. Some will become, therefore, later subdivided into the administrative units known as hundreds, which is what happens in our area of South Oxfordshire. This area may originally have been a shear of about 100 square miles. The shear stretched over a large area in the loop of the Thames, the Southern Chilterns, Benson to Henley, and over time it became subdivided into a number of administrative units known as the Hundred, 4.5 hundreds of which become the famed Chiltern Hundreds. I say famed because it used to be the only way to resign as an MP was to apply for the non-existent office of the Chiltern Hundreds. It was an odd system, but hey. Anyway, back when we are looking, 7th and 8th centuries, it will become a royal estate, the shire, part of the personal estates of the King of the Gewissa. Then it will be half-inched from the Gewissa and become part of the royal estates of the Mercian kings, and then back again to the Gewissa and the West Saxons. I mean, these are borderlands, there and back again, like Bilbo's road that goes on forever. This shire we're going to look at was centred on Benson. This was in a royal estate centre, often called a vill or a township. First of all, though, let us talk about the manner in which these shires were managed in the 7th and 8th centuries. This was described by a thoroughly eminent historian of my youth, G.W. Barrow, as a kind of extensive lordship. Extensive here, as I say, used as the opposite of intensive, if you see what I mean. A lordship that was broad and high level, rather than detailed and very specific. A little distant. And like Joey's pants, a little loose. This extensive lordship was characterised by a lord who was often, or maybe even usually, absent physically. So he and his queen and family only really paid attention to the shire when they were in town, and they travelled constantly. The king exercised rights over the self-sufficient peasantry that lived there, his churls, who practised agriculture in a series of small, scattered settlements. You can forget the England you see now as you hurtle around in Lycra and the Peloton, or indeed in your car. You can forget that classic England of nucleated visit villages based around a pretty church and a manor house and the local sewage plant. That all lies in the future. And their arrival will be very much part of this series, actually, later on. Well, not the sewage plant, but you know. But we're not there yet, now that the Romans are no more. Their towns, of course, lie broken and deserted for only the poets to wonder at. For which, by the way, see The Ruins from the 9th century Exeter book. A very evocative Anglo-Saxon poem, similar in a way to Charlton Heston kneeling before the broken Statue of Liberty in that film. Though without the nuclear war thing, or indeed sewage plants. Anyway, I'll pop a link to The Ruins on the website for the series. Anyway. The point is, Britain before the 800s, with the exception of the Roman period, was a countryside of dispersed farms, forts and halls. For the main part, then, we are talking about very small settlements composed of a family and their dependents working together to farm their land, based on the hide farm, which we talked about briefly last time. The hide, a unit of land sufficient to maintain a family. It is a term which will come up frequently, so I might point out that the hide is deliciously analogue, because the amount of land needed to maintain a family would be much larger on arable, fertile and easy-to-work Norfolk land than it would be in the rocky highlands of Cumbria. Isn't that nice? Delightfully connected with the realities of life. In late medieval times, though, the hide gets regularised and as administrators just don't like such chaos. And it becomes recognised broadly as being about 120 acres, or 48.5623 hectares. But it would have been much smaller in them old days of Anglo-Saxon yore, or indeed, depend on where you were. This then is joined by the five hide unit although I'll talk about that later, the Five Hive unit becomes a culturally and financially significant unit, since it is the basic amount of land required to maintain an armed and fully equipped warrior. So hold on to the idea of the Five Hive unit. We'll return to it like a dog to its bone. One more thing is that the word hide itself is also witness to the triumph of the West Saxon Brigade after Alfred. We are all West Saxons now, as well as all being socialists. Because in the Dane law, including Norfolk, of course, there is a similar concept to the hide, but the unit is not called a hide, it is in fact called a carucat. In Kent, I think, they might also be called yokes and sulongs, so I apologise, everyone, for my West Saxon centricity. But let's keep it simple. I give you, ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys, and indeed all genders, I give you the hide. Back then to those kings and lords of the shears, full of hide farms, ruled by a loose collection of lordly rights under the general title of extensive lordship. Now, as I mentioned, these kings and lords, they didn't just sit still in one hall or palace, as we like to imagine of kings and lords of Narnia and stuff like that, or Denethor and all that. They travelled. They travelled from shear to shear, township to township. They travelled to show themselves to their people. The very stuff of lordship was to meet face to face, personal relationships, see and be seen, to show off their greatness and wealth, listen to the needs and issues and advice of their followers, to distribute gifts. As they travelled, they would feed themselves and their household by calling in the custom of hospitality, the render or tribute called the feorum. The feorum is an English version of an obligation and institution that has a long tradition throughout Europe. Now, there is not much surplus around from subsistence farms in this time, so they took only what a churl could afford, a little bit from a lot of farms, basically. But the process of feorum becomes systematised, structured, planned for. I mean, how embarrassing would it be for the lord and lady to turn up with all those hungry mouths to feed and entertainments to run, and yet the larder would be dry, except that old package of last year's mince pies you forgot to eat for Christmas and thoughtfully put by for next year. You can go up to a grand lady, shove a tart at her and say, "They, I'll ass wrap your tonsils round that," would you? You couldn't do that very well, could you? So, the kings began to set up permanent tribute centres, places where the tribute could be gathered throughout the need when they were needed, and of course they would then serve as a location where the king could meet his people as well. So over the season, people would come down from their farms and hills and bring their required produce to the tribute centre to fulfil their forthcoming obligation of hospitality. Then they'd return to their valleys and their farms with no desire to be brothers in arms until next time, or until the king called them in. Called them in to meet and feast with him and his family and household. Places like this then have been excavated. At a place called Higham Ferrers, there is a series of buildings that serviced a great hall just across the River Neen at a place called Earthlingborough, or just across the River Nen, depending on where you come from. High Ferrers were surrounded by a large enclosure, acting as a pen for livestock which had been brought as part of the feorum. It had a ditch, probably topped by a thorn hedge. Inside the enclosure was accommodation for a small permanent workforce, with storage buildings, malting ovens and a mill. There are other such places that have been excavated too, at Yeavering and Cowdrey's Down in Oxfordshire. Evidence of outside halls for storing more resources than would have been needed immediately by any one family. Archaeology has also found evidence of cattle which was raised elsewhere, driven long distances to pay feorum at these centres. It's also found evidence of grain processed elsewhere and driven there by wagon load to the centre. There is a slide with an imagining of how one of these centres would have looked like on the accompanying PDF slide 16, I think. But the biggest, best and most recent example is one that I did a podcast on for the History of England. It is a place called Rendlesham, and you can hop along to the History of England and listen. It's not very long. Rendlesham, then, is in the Deben River Valley in southeast Suffolk. It is connected with a landscape that includes the royal burial site at Snape, and most famously, at Sutton Hoo. where the best bet is that the 7th century Bretwalder of the Wafinger is buried, Radwald. Rendlesham has been revealed as the largest royal vill and tribute centre yet uncovered by a dig, with a heyday that stretched from somewhere around 570 all the way through for 160 years to the 730s. There was a great hall there, set in a royal complex, and when the king was in town the whole site would have been flooded with temporary market stalls and tents and people who came from far and wide, including overseas. The churls and farmers from around the shire would have flooded in to be feasted and entertained, on their own food, essentially, and here their lord dispensed justice with the help of his people and his earlish, his nobles. The quality of the feast gave face to his lord, the quality of his hospitality, but also it gave face to his people. This is payback for all those renders. This is the custom of hospitality at work. This is the dignity and respect and service due to and from the lord and lady for their family's preeminence. It was a very important opportunity for the local elite of the Deben Valley, a chance to meet their lord, look him in the eyes, and get access to his ear to discuss the troubles and issues of the day. This was a big event, capital B, capital E. The people who came along to meet their lord might be described as peasants in the sense they're all farmers and all essentially subsistence farmers with their little bit of surplus for the fiorum. But the word peasant is very misleading for Anglo-Saxon society because peasant implies class and inferior status. It implies a coherent class of people who recognise that they're of the same sort, working the land, and with that inferior status, as I say, and that is not the way society works at this time. We have not had that idea of villeinage, of the legally unfree serf, which arrives later, and which will create that derogatory flavour of the word peasant, and indeed churlish, a word that comes from churl, wrongly, of course, because the churl was just like the noble, they were free. The word churl derives from the word carl, which means free man or woman. So, although of lower status, due to a variety of factors that we'll come to, they nonetheless demand respect and honour. A churl, in theory, is still a warrior. They are able to bear arms, and they can be called out for military service at any time. I mean, in practical terms, their military function gets less and less important. And one sign of that is that of all the men buried before 525 AD, fully 40% were buried with a spear. Between 525 and 625, that percentage falls to 33% carrying a spear, and after 625, only 20% are armed. What this means is not that war and the right and concept of carrying arms becomes culturally any less important. It doesn't. But in practical terms, it was much less common. Instead, a purely warrior class begins to emerge, employed in the household of the noble, rather than doubling up as a farmer. But status, rather than being based simply on class, rested on a number of factors. The basic division was, of course, between noble and churl, earlish and churlish, as we've said, and this was reflected in law codes as something called the Weargild. Weargild defined the compensation due to individuals of different rank, and the ranks are defined as earl, thane and churl very broadly. The law codes even give them a monetary value. But those weargilds overlap, so the lower orders of thane might have a weargild the same as a prosperous churl, and weargild anyway was a very broad definition of rank. Just as important was the concept, the much more nebulous concept, of weorder. Your worth, reputation, standing. You must be seen to be worthy of your weargild to gain respect. You must live up to the standard of the weargild. A person with a strong reputation, weorder, would find deals easier to make, credit easier to obtain, find their lords more willing to offer them support and listen to their advice and concerns. Weorder might be affected by material things, the amount of land you held, for example, but it wasn't defined by the amount of land you held, as it would later be. It was affected by your compliance with those reciprocal codes of society, implicit in fiorum and hospitality, lordship and responsibilities of commendation. It might also be affected by your trade, your skills, or the tasks you fulfil. So, blacksmiths seem to have had a special value, for example. Traction, power, was an absolutely critical factor in surviving. So, the family that owned a plough and team of oxen, hugely expensive to buy and maintain, well, they were local dignitaries, shiny bright sword or no shiny bright sword, because they had the means of survival at hand. But altogether, across the piece, Weorder was derived from your ability to live up to the requirements of the moral economy, the responsibilities of your rank, delivering fiorum, carrying out judicial service, military service, attendance on your lord, the reciprocal giving and receiving of honour and service and dignity. Anyway, back to the big hooly. When all was done with the feasting and the buying and the selling, the king or lord and his household would move on. Rendlesham would remain, though. Maybe 100 to 200 people would be permanent, among them the king's agent, or the king's reeve, as he would be called. And some craftsmen and women would also remain, making ready for next time. Where, then, did all this fiorum come from within the shire? And how did the lord and his reeve know it wouldn't always be just apples in Somerset, wheat in Suffolk, and beef in Cumbria, and pork pies in Melton Mowbray? It is time, then, for another term, sadly, that of multiple estate. The idea of a multiple estate is that a geographical unit, such as a shire, must be able to deliver the full range of products required for its inhabitants and a full and pleasant life for its lordly family. So, the shire must contain a number of different estates, all producing enough for subsistence, but also with some areas of specialisation. Or, I suppose that might be described as products they were notably well designed or placed to produce. No one's suggesting that a particular designated farm would be dedicated to beef production, as might be done now. But farms centred on rough pasture might well be expected to have a large component of cattle in their output. So, when you tipped up at a tribute centre, you didn't really want just oats. You'd want a number of grains, you'd want livestock, you'd need wool, leather, honey, so on. The shire would be healthier if it could produce a good range of stuff for its inhabitants and be insulated against the vagaries of weather and topography by that variety. Each of the estates on the shire would also have their own profiles, their own composition or farmers, and a sort of centre where people would get together, a tunisheep, a township. Don't think village or nucleated settlement, but maybe a small hamlet where people and neighbours might gather from time to time, places where they could talk about the practicalities of farming, arrange the sharing of resources such as oxen or plough teams that only the very richest could afford, but which everyone needed. As time goes by, there'll be administrative units, the townships. They'll gather people together into groups called tithings for legal assemblies of their lord when he's at the central tribute centre or vill for one of his visits. But think about townships, importantly, as being bottom-up things, their local farmers getting together on their own terms, as opposed to the lord's vill and tribute centre, which is top-down, the lord taking fiorum, handing out feasts and justice to his people. The townships are social centres, where families can meet and consult people who are respected across the shire. Those might be holy people or cunning women or the elders of the area, those with the wisest heads, the 7th century equivalent to podcasters, effectively. Farm workers might get together after work for some entertainment, so there are references to Yebor Sheeper, a beer ship, where everyone would take turns singing along to a harp while drinking of the beer. The rule was, apparently, that everyone had to take a turn, which doesn't sound like a good idea for me. Okey-dokey, back to the tribute centres, the central vill. As I say, these vills were not deserted when the lord had moved on. Someone had to manage the estate. Someone had to make sure everything was ready for the lord and his household when they returned, gathering and storing tribute from the communities around. And so appeared the all-powerful reeve, a resident estate manager for the king, essentially. The reeve themselves would be accompanied, no doubt, by a household with slaves. However, there is an important point to make here. These centres were not themselves big farms or domain farms directly farming for the Lord, as we will see in later centuries, they are not there themselves to produce all that loot for the Lord. They're not farming their whole estates. There's just a small home farm there to produce a bit for the reeve and his household. They might, however, be a centre where craft activities were concentrated, ironworking, for example, a centre of resource and expertise upon which the scattered settlements of the churls living in the shire might draw. Essentially, the reeve is there to manage all those multiple estates on behalf of the Lord. Now, I can see you are wondering at what kind of thing people might take as feorum when the time came. I can see you asking that. And to give you a flavour of those sorts of things, it's handy to nip along to the laws of Ina, as is common late on a Saturday night when the drinking and dancing is done. Get out those old laws of Ina, would you? Hopefully you will all remember old Ina, the early 8th century king of Wessex who ended his life by abdicating and travelling to Rome, there to found the Scola Saxorum for other English travellers. In 694, Ina produced a law code, one of the earliest, and one of the things it did was define the sort of tribute a lord might expect from his large multiple estates. And the entry gives a practical flavour of what we're talking about. Here goes. 10 vats of honey, 300 loaves, 12 ambers of Welsh ale, 30 ambers of clear ale, 2 full-grown cows or 10 wethers, 10 geese, 20 hens, 10 cheeses, a full amber of butter, 5 salmon, 20 pounds in weight of fodder, and 100 eels. This is a thing of beauty, which evokes an image of the produce of a typical estate. You might want some interpretation and a sense of scale. So, Welsh ale, for example, this was a dark and strong ale, probably a survival from the British, hence the name. It might also be a braggart, which was an ale fermented with honey. An amber was a vessel with one handle like a bucket or a large jug, probably derived from a Germanicized version of the Latin for amphora. And amber therefore became a liquid measure. Now, I was asked how much was an amber, and I confess to you that I do not know and do not know still. Some may say between 2 and 6 gallons, others may say 309 gallons. Sadly, no one else knows either, as far as I can see. The amount of fodder, though, 20 pounds, is not very much, and that's probably because the king would expect to be given grazing pasture for his horses at each place he visited anyway. The 300 loaves might have supported a family for around 150 days, so that's a reasonable amount. But the quantities are rather difficult to interpret, and that is the big question. How tough was this tribute? Once upon a time, the view was that it was quite a heavy imposition. The old master, Frank Stenton, for example, considered it so. But with more recent analysis, opinion has moved on. So this render in Ina's laws was levied on 10 hides of land, and that is a substantial amount of land. And in the context of the general social trend we will be describing, which is about how the hand of lordship becomes heavier over time, it is probable that your farmer of the 10th century would look back to a tribute of this kind in the 8th century with misty-eyed wonder and envy and mutter, "Those were the days," before drowning his sorrows in weak ale, or indeed in braggart. There are some other examples. Here's a feorum attached to Hickling and Kinalton in Northamptonshire, which asks for 80 bushels of malt for brewing, 40 bushels of oatmeal, 80 bushels of flour, 8 sides of bacon, 16 cheeses, 2 fat cows, and 8 salmon. There appears to be no suggestion that the 2 fat cows need to come out of the Nile. A bushel. Now, a bushel is about 8 gallons, so that's 640 gallons of malt and so on. Professor Chris Dyer, author of more books on social and economic history than you can shake a stick at, he worked out that all of this would be the annual produce of about 30 acres of land, which is a typical peasant's yard land in later medieval times. If that is the case, and I am not worthy so much as to pick up the bushels of wheat from under Chris Dyer's historical table, and so I'm not going to argue, then this feorum was a small fraction of the produce of the 2 settlements in question. Now, Now, as it becomes regularised and regular, the Fiorum does indeed begin to look awfully like a tax, doesn't it? One approach to describe all this, then, is as feigned reciprocity. That basically means it's a way for the king to extract goodies from his subjects, but legitimise it as hospitality, give it a nice name and a good gloss. And it's true, to a degree, that the net result is indistinguishable from a tax. But two things about that. Firstly, this is not a tax based on land. Many chels held their land as of right, not from the grant of a king or a lord. It's theirs and their heirs. They are landowners, not tenants or mere landholders. This is not a relationship based on land in return for military service, feudalism, as it will be called. Secondly, rightly or wrongly, everyone seems to believe in it. In the search to define the moral economy of the Anglo-Saxon state, here is one, an idea of action and the appropriate response, what is owed in return, as an English text had it, the principle of reciprocity. But it must be said, this render is no longer optional. If it's not there, there'll be trouble. Start knitting arse covers for the next time the king tips up and asks for his buns. Fiorum brings us back to the E word, extensive. The point about extensive lordship, then, was that the pressure from above in terms of Fiorum was really not very heavy at all. There is no great administration there also to extract it and define it. There is no upward pressure on the amounts, and the amounts themselves, it appears, are not high. There was no great incentive for the travelling king or magnate to try and squeeze his tenants. He was travelling around, sharing the load. He couldn't take that much with him. Lordly households were comparatively small in those days. And as long as he looked good and was able to feast and entertain and hunt when he rolled into Shire, then there was no great need or incentive to squeeze any harder. A golden age indeed. So, it's a little from a lot of farmers. And the system is progressive in the sense that the amount demanded was based on your wealth, how much you had. If you were too small to produce more than your family needed to survive, there was no tribute to give. But at the moment, the lord is generally taking their rights in kind as well, as in Ina's law, in stuff, food mainly. But there is in the background the concept of cash still rolling around. A cash value is in itself important and helpful as a yardstick, a measure, a term of reference, even if you're not using a coin. So the Weir Guilds, for example, were expressed in cash terms in shillings. They probably wouldn't be paid in coin, or not all of it anyway. But it's a useful way to give an agreed definition of value. But cash in the form of coin will indeed have its day, of course, and will help transform life for many. Two things about that. The lord would dearly like to convert at least some of their tribute in kind into a rather more convertible and portable format. So they might be drowning in Welsh ale, but be desperate to buy themselves a nice series of gold torques for their warriors. From this desire will appear the idea of cash tribute, to which you can be sure we will return. On a more practical level, the farmer themselves would rather like to be able to buy farm implements or have things fixed with an easier method of exchange than what they produced. So the idea of all levels of society being able to find a place, a market, where they could convert produce into cash, that is important and will be popular when it arrives. That may give the impression, by the way, that there is no cash at all, and that is not so. The idea and use of cash has never gone away, but it is relatively rare and bullion is in short supply. The mechanisms for converting food and produce into cash are hard to find. There are, for example, no towns to go to sell your stuff to merchants. Also, the denominations of coins can be way too high for small-scale local transactions. Coins are therefore often cut into pieces. Though the small silver penny introduced in the late 7th century does help with this. No one is quite sure how communities deal with the financial exchange in those early centuries, but probably credit has a lot to do with it, like keeping a monthly tab at your local grocery store, and then dealing periodically in kind, services or goods for service or goods. However, money and coinage is always important. Kings continue to issue coins, and also they continue to rigorously regulate the value and bullion content of coinage. So they very often call it all in, all the coins, and then reissue them. That's because as coins get old, they get chipped, people chew the edges off them for the gold value and all that sort of thing. So they need to be kept good. And as I said, coins and denominations remain a crucial reference point for the most basic local transaction. You have to be able to price stuff somehow. One more thing then about these multiple estates before we finish. I mentioned that one of the reasons they are called multiple estates is because of the many different types of resource available. And within the estate, farmers might specialise to some degree. We're not talking coals from Newcastle or shoes from Northampton here. And remember, Anglo-Saxon farmers needed to produce the vast majority of what they needed to eat and to use to survive. But with their surplus capacity, if they had any, they could specialise according to the qualities of their own land, because, of course, the ability to modify land and its quality was much more limited than it is today. So they had to think about what they had. And you can see some of this variety in place names. There was a study done on a parish in the county of Cheshire. Within the parish there is a place called Bickerton. That means beekeeper's farm. Then there's a place called Bulkley, which means bullocks clearing, essentially a patch of open pasture used for rearing cattle. There's a Stockton, which means an enclosure at a dairy hamlet. And then finally, there is a place called Whitchurch, which means valley at the market. That could be about the production of salt. So in those names, you have indications that within a parish, possibly part of an old shire, there were various estates with various specialisations. I did promise that we would be talking about our own area to work all of this through, and so let me finish by doing just that. Look at our shire of Benston. It seems likely that there would have been a Rendlesham-type tribute centre at Benston, and it may even have been found recently, according to recent studies, with a 7th or 8th century hall-type structure at Benston. The 100 square miles of our royal shire is probably about 500 hides, so again, it's big old territory. Its place names suggest a classic multiple estate. Benson and its surrounding lowland area has a variety of agricultural land, but its land these days graded as either level 1 or level 2, so that's basically good. The best is the fertile and easy to work greensand under the hills I spoke of around Watlington, but there was also good soil set on gravel beds and therefore easy to work around Benson itself, with heavier gault clay around villages like the Hazleys, fertile but frankly heavy and stodgy and very hard to work with an hard plough. It is in these better soils, though, that cultivation in the shire is at its most intensive and the use of labour the heaviest. Just to give you a plot spoiler for next time, it's in these areas of intensive agriculture around the Royal Vill that something called inland will develop. Land farmed directly by the king's agents, by peasants who are increasingly unfree. Nota bene. Although these areas around the Vill focus on arable, the kind of crops has actually changed from Roman times. So the Romans focused very much on wheat and barley. The oats focused on a much wider range of grain with lower risk, so rye, oats as well. And they mix in pulses, beans and peas, rather more of those. Arable production fell in general and was mixed, even in the lowland, with greater emphasis on pastoralism, so an increase in the number of sheep, goats and pigs. And then there's the upland estates up in the Chiltern Hills. There is a combination of ground, areas of marginal arable, frankly infertile and pretty useless gravel, and a lot of heavy clay cap on chalk. Very little settlement up there. But in the context of multiple estates, it's perfect, because your uplands provide wood, and the Chilterns to this day have a relatively high proportion of woodland. The infertile gravel or clay is used for rough pasture, for sheep or for cattle, so you can drive your cattle and sheep up into the hills for pasture when you're not using them to fertilise your fallow fields, and they won't get in the way of the arable fields. In the early centuries, 600s and 700s, there was probably not much pressure on the land down in the vale, but as population grew, the importance of the resource in the hills would grow ever more valuable to keep the arable fields doing what they're best at and producing those grain and pulses. The names of some of these hill settlements demonstrate, meanwhile, that there's a bit of specialisation going on, just as we saw in Cheshire. So Swinkham, for example, means Valley of the Pigs. Pishill means hill where the peas grow. Rotherfield, as I believe I have mentioned before, means clearing for cows. But also, the uplands are perfect for the entertainment of kings, hunting. The number of people is probably very small up there indeed, and when in town, the king and his household would go hunting. That's even reflected in the name of one of the settlements, Huntercombe, Hunter's Valley. In terms of political identity, Benson and its shire was frontier land between the West Saxons, as the Gwisa will become known, and the Mercians. The links into the shire from Mercian lands from the north were strong along Roman routes and northeast along the Icknield Way, and inland trade seems to have been developing along that route and at the Scarpfoot settlement of Ewelm. Mercia, and especially its most powerful king, the 8th century Offa, was constantly pushing to extend its territory fully to the banks of the Thames or even across the banks of the Thames. So while Chorlin and his West Saxon successors were in the ascendant, Benson and nearby Dorchester were clearly Saxon. Coongills established a bishopric at Dorchester. His successor, Quicham, was baptised a Christian there, and so presumably, bit by bit, their shire was Christianised as well, as the emerging Kingdom of Wessex was also to follow suit. But the West Saxon kings were not consistently successful, so they didn't always have ownership. In 628, the last pagan, the Mercian war leader Penda, defeated Coongills at Cirencester, so battling for the Thames Valley. 150 years later, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle records a battle at the royal villa of Benson itself, with Offa defeating the king of the West Saxons, Cunawulf of Wessex. What impact all of this would have had on local identity and loyalties is impossible to know at this distance. But there are signs in the landscape of the significance to the local people of war and contested land in the names of the area. One of these is the naming of a boundary, which also becomes the meeting place for the shire's Fulkerjemot, its folk assembly. This is called Chilwulf's Tree. That's interesting because it's a name with close connections to both Mercian and West Saxon royal houses. Then, on the rising slopes from Benson, is a feature called Sior Dina. Victory Ridge, that means. And then there's Gilas Brache, Hostages Ridge, also close by. So whatever specific events those names signify, and it would be lovely to know, they are at very least a record of dispute and conflict and a conscious naming for public memory of the shire's very own local history and therefore very own local identity. Oakley Doakley, I think that's enough for now. Just to recap, in the 7th and 8th century, as population of Anglo-Saxon England grows, elites and hierarchies begin to appear and strengthen as a new nobility. Society remains based largely on personal bonds between men and women and their lord. This is not a society based on contract, rent, that sort of thing, but on reciprocal customs around a personal bond. Those kings, sub-kings and lords rule tribal territories called shires, many of which will end up becoming grouped together by marriage, conquest or negotiation, into the political organisations we recognise, the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. Shires were political groupings, but within them were economic and social subdivisions, the farms, tunashipsa, that together produced the tribute to sustain the elites. These estates also get called multiple estates by historians, since they were often large and contained a full array of landscapes and produce, which gave the inhabitants all the range of resources they needed to thrive. Tribute centres develop to gather the output of these estates, tribute legitimised by the tradition of hospitality. This was a world of independent free peasants and light, extensive lordship, where the yoke of hierarchy and lordship relatively lightly on the shoulders of the English churlish family. Next time, we will hear how, in some cases, those relationships begin to intensify and the experience of the English peasantry begins to change, depending on whether the land you farm is on inland or warland estates, which are two concepts we will also explain next time. Until then, thanks very much for listening, folks. Do get in touch with comments, questions and so on. And failing that, I'll be back in 2 weeks' time to talk about the areas where life does indeed become harder. Life on the inland. Until then, good luck everyone and have a great fortnight.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.